this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us poet and writer Pamela Moore Dionne, whose work has appeared in a number of journals, including Shenandoah and Pontoon. She was a Jack Straw writer and received their artist support grant to record a CD of her Sabina Spielrein Guzzel series of poems. Pam has earned a Centrum residency and an Artist Trust Gap Grant. Her visual art has been published in journals and presented in one-woman shows. Other credits include founding and managing the online art and literature journal Literary Salt. She was also the founder of Discovery Bay Games. Currently, she is enrolled in the Goddard College MFAW program. She teaches a no-cost 8-week course for the Writers' Workshop, and it's called Let's Make a Scene here in Port Townsend, Washington. Welcome to the program, Pam.
Thank you.
I'm glad you could come to the studio so we can talk face to face. And I'm excited about learning about your history as a writer, as a poet, and about your decisions to pursue an MFA. That's possibly a good place to start. After a career in which you've published poems and published other work and had successes, where does the MFA fit and why now?
Well, the MFA fits because I'm working on a novel, and it's essentially a family saga. It's a narrative done in two voices juxtaposed against one another and alternating, which I guess you could look at The Hours by Michael Cunningham as using a similar approach to this. It's a novel about the ways in which families wound one another, but also find the wherewithal to forgive. Ultimately, it's a novel about redemption of two different women, a mother and a daughter. The MFA program is the way in which I can figure out plot arc, character arc, scene arc, and really I'm coming to an understanding that a novel length is much better if every scene has an arc and an evolution.
Can you tell us just a little bit about what a scene arc would be?
In a scene, if you look at it as the narrator, as the camera, that's the way that worked better for me. Everything that occurs in the scene has to matter to carry the story forward. And a story has an arc, so every scene will come to a high point in the tension or the conflict. And then it will slowly evolve down to a calmer place, or it will actually rise to a higher place in order to set the next scene up. So you kind of ride a roller coaster through the entire novel, and the scene is just like a tiny novel. It'll have the same roller coaster ride if you do it correctly. The MFA program is teaching me how to do that.
So when you're writing, are you constantly thinking about this, or is this sort of you pump it out and then you go back and see what you can do?
I pump it out, and everyone will work differently. I need to get that story out there, which is maybe 10% of the work of writing a novel, and then the rest is all edit.
A lot of writers say that writing is in the revision.
I believe that.
Do you think in this way of thinking, all scenes are equal, or are there some that are different lengths and have different purposes?
I'm not sure I would consider all scenes equal, but they have to have similar levels of purpose. And I think a scene has to have a purpose within the novel, and that purpose has to be to move the story forward. Some scenes can be soft. They can be a moment of, like I mentioned before, a moment of redemption between the characters on stage at that time. I guess the way I just described it is probably the way a dramatist would describe a scene.
Do you find yourself reading plays?
I have read plays, and they have been really helpful. I've read plays that I've already enjoyed, like Fences, a number of times. I've seen it a number of times, too. One thing I have learned in working with Goddard through the MFA program is that it isn't a good idea to look at the way other authors are setting scene or developing character or building the plot arc to a logical pinnacle that then evolves into what is a believable ending. It's something that eluded me while I was trying to teach myself to write a novel, something that I've had a major aha about mm-hmm. through the Goddard program and the advisors that I've worked with.
Do you have any idea about why it's elusive unless you're really learning from somebody and paying attention?
For me, I chose for many, many years not to read anything while I was writing a novel-length manuscript, not to read anything that was remotely similar to what I was doing because I was afraid I would steal. And of course, I have since learned that everyone steals, but you have to recreate it as your own. And you can look at a concept and the way another author has dealt with that concept within their narrative, and you don't have to copy that. In fact, you absolutely should not. But you truthfully can learn from a technique that's being used and figure out how to adapt that to your own work. And it's of value.
One of the things that I learned early on was that when we read any form of art that's been published, we're seeing a finished product, which if you look at it with your writing in progress eyes, you're learning lessons. But if you look at it as kind of whatever jumps on my page better look like that, totally wonderful, it's very, very hard to continue because we're not up to snuff. We look at it, we can kind of tell the difference between what we just put out and what this favorite novel of ours is like. And so to remember always that we already mentioned revision and that the work of writing is in layers.
Absolutely.
Because it's not done in our minds alone. It seems to be an interaction between what's on the page and what we listen to when we read it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And that's why a novel, manuscripts, takes so long to go from beginning to culmination. It's important to spend the time that it's going to take to make it function the way it should or can if you give it that effort. One of the things I think that gets in my way with the novel-length narrative is that I don't give it the same weight, the revision, I don't give it the same weight that I do a poem. Mm-hmm. What I'm learning is just live with the flaws in that initial laying down of the idea, because that's really all it is. It's an outline for what's going to happen, basically. And just relax into it not being perfect. And don't even look to have a piece of perfection when you've gone through it once. It's not going to be good. So it's going to be an idea.
Yeah. What keeps you going, knowing that this is going to take time, that this is a process, that it takes a while to get it right, that novels take a long time? How do you face that in your writing life?
It's a game for me. It's a word game. I paint these characters into corners all the time. The joy is figuring out how to get them back out of there. And how to get them back out of there so that it's logical and believable, and so that you have a chance to interact with your reader in a way that makes it a relationship. And it's not that I think about my reader while I'm working on the play or on the narrative.
While you're playing with the narrative.
Yeah, I'm playing with the narrative. Because that can't ever enter into it for me. There's a different purpose in the writing out the concept. For me, I hope that one day I will be making people laugh or making them cry. And it's all about wordplay. It's all about characters who mean something, who we can relate to. So I relate to my characters. They become very real to me. I think about them pretty much constantly.
So that's all fun.
It's all fun. Yeah.
So one way to keep going is to enjoy the whole process.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I know you came prepared to read a scene, and this would be a really good time for us to see. Now, would you consider this one that you've worked on the arc that you described to us?
I have, and this is actually setting the scene up. So because we're limited for time that can be read. So I stopped this at a point where I thought it made logical sense. It does go on to more complexity. But it starts out with a little easier to follow and then builds.
Okay.
So the novel's working title is Ash and Bone, and this is from the mother's narrative set in 1950. She came home from school to a note telling her that her afternoon snack was in the fridge and her mother would be home soon. It was her mother's handwriting, but just barely. The lines were all shaky, and she knew why. He'd beaten Mama really bad last night. Louise looked around cautiously, certain that she wasn't alone. She shivered, but shook it off. Where could Mama have gone? Louise shrugged out of her penny loafers and tiptoed to peek out the kitchen door. Her body buzzed with constant, almost, vibrations. It was like the feeling she got riding the bus, but this wasn't nice. This felt like a scream rising in her body toward her throat. The frigid air hummed and pinged as she edged just beyond the door's frame so she could check the hall. Turning her head left, then right, right, then left, she breathed a deep sigh, but it didn't do anything to ease her fear. Mama couldn't drive, so maybe she didn't go far. But what if Aunt Bonnie came and got Mama? Maybe she was hurt really, really bad and had to go to the hospital. Maybe she wouldn't ever come home. With that, all the air in her body seemed to disappear. She couldn't breathe. Shadows started closing her view of the already dark hallway. She bent forward, touching the floor with both hands while she concentrated on taking deep breaths. Mama taught her this trick last year, and she was better at it now. She continued breathing deep, regular breaths, while listening the way she imagined a bird on the ground would listen for cats. Gradually, she felt her heart slow into its usual calm kind of beat. Surrounding her was quiet, scary quiet, like her father sometimes. In the silence, every creak and snap startled her. What if he's here, just waiting, like a snake? The kitchen, void of her mother's presence, was a first. But where was her father? At work, please, at work.
What strikes me is that your training as a poet, to me, is pretty evident in here in terms of the specifics and the similes. She compares her feelings to other feelings. The buzzing isn't as nice as the bus, for instance. How it feels to be on the floor like a cat looking for birds. And I think prose writers do that a lot, but I think that poetry helps people do that and think that way. And I feel very in her moment as you read, which I think is very laudable. And I also admire the way time is slowed down. This is kind of a huge psychological moment, and we get to have that time as listener in this case, as reader in the future, to be there in her fear.
Well, good. That's what I was hoping for.
Well, it's what I feel. I'm hoping he's at work, too, and I hope her mom comes home and takes her away. But we'll see, right? Probably won't happen that easily.
No way.
No, because that's life and that's writing. Mm-hmm. And I remember working on screenplays with a friend, a colleague, and she kept saying, we have to torque it up for these characters. We have to make it hard on them. And it was really hard for both of us to do that. And I'm sure that that's part of the writing challenge for you, too, is what does it feel like to be not nice to these characters?
Yeah, you do love your characters. Or if you don't love them, they get edited out. I had several characters that I thought, well, you know, I'm not really invested in them, and have tossed them from the whole novel. They didn't serve enough purpose in carrying the story forward. And I clearly was not as much in love or involved with just their constructs as people in my mind.
But when you love them, isn't it hard to
do really hard to parts? It's really hard to put those barriers up in their way. But we all live those. We all overcome those. And it's a way that I can relate to my characters.
Right. We all hope to overcome them. And reading a book like yours is one way that people have the support to overcome them.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with Port Townsend resident Pamela Dion about her recent fiction and her current experience in the Goddard Low Residency MFA program.
When you're talking about drafting scenes and that how you come to see the first parts you put on the page as outlines or just rough beginnings, there's something that I want to ask you about surprises. So you have this thing that looks like this is how the scene's going to go, and then you start working the scene for the arc. Do you experience a surprise? Like, oh, this scene is about something different than I thought it would be about.
Absolutely, and I really love those moments. Actually, this character, who starts out here as an 8-year-old girl, this character created something that I was not expecting and caused me a lot more research time. And I loved it. So I have to say, it made her more endearing to me as a character and more flawed, which I guess because I have my flaws, I like my characters to at least share that with me.
Well, we say about personal essay writing that we don't write in order to appear righteous. We write in order to show our humility and our less than ideal aspects. And that's what readers connect with, because there's somebody who's honest about and authentic about what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. So your characters are being very human, and we love them for
hopefully.
It.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you remember having that moment in writing this scene or another scene where, oh, I didn't think this was true, but hey, my character is telling me.
I can remember that moment exactly because I've been dancing around it ever since it occurred and doing more and more editing and more research. It starts with a scene that I was not expecting to happen, and it's the girl who's now 8 at the age of 17 who turns her father's belt on him instead of her.
Whoa. And that was shocking to you.
It was a surprise, total surprise. Yeah. Didn't shock me too much. I kind of cheered her on.
All right. But you didn't know it was coming.
No.
And neither will the reader, I bet, until it happens.
I hope not.
Yeah. It just happened, or the words that led you there? Or
the words. Words in the scene always do the leading, I think. I mean, I have an outline, just really rough outline for this overall novel, and I know how it will end. Actually, at the time you begin the novel, it's already ended, but you don't know that yet. You come around, back around to where the narratives melt and take you to that
well,
realization.
In good writing, they say that whether the writer knows it or not, when they start, the beginning always contains the ending. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to get to the ending to know that, but in working through your plot and stuff, you got there.
Yeah.
So that's beautiful. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
When I read the book, I'll try not to think about the ending. I'll just try to read. So how about we switch over to your poetry side?
Okay.
And I know that you have a couple to read to us and had some recent successes with these poems.
Yeah, both of these poems were published in the 2017 spring issue of the Pitkin Review. Gulls drop like rags through rain falling in rivers. The bay chews and gnashes each bird as it settles into the slate-gray chop of a storm driven onto shore by a vengeance only southern winds can muster. Two eagles, one a first-year juvenile, batter their way through sky more solid than air is meant to be. The adolescent, out of control, moves her wings as though a stroke is possible against 50-mile-an-hour gusts. She plummets 30 feet toward the water's toothy surface. A flash of white head and tail, the larger adult glides close, almost too close. At the last minute, both blast upward on outstretched wings, vertical, held steady against a crazy current of opportunity and chance.
You witnessed that firsthand, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to write that. A very exciting thing to see. Danger and success.
The birds nest near our house, so we watch the babies learning to fly, learning to hunt. It's
being adolescent.
Yes, being adolescent and maybe not as graceful as they might be otherwise.
Uh-huh. Thank you. I really enjoyed listening. And I love how you read the last line again, or last couple lines.
Both blast upward on outstretched wings, vertical, held steady against a crazy current of opportunity and chance.
Yes, that's life, isn't it? Opportunity and chance.
Yeah.
Thank you. Want to read the second one?
This is actually something I did too. Mount Eleanor. Gravity screams lion-voiced on the west side. I'm trapped. A tight glissade run, worn deep by other climbers, ice, razors, blue-white blur, slope rushes upward against thighs, buttocks, below me a rock stack, huge, unyielding, stone-cold air, urine scent of mountain goat, blood-salt taste, sharp teeth clashing against tongue, sound, a desperate creature caught in the cavern of my mouth, its arc fighting a larynx taut with adrenaline. Tethered to my skittering axe, useless trail of ballast, I faint, parry. The blade batters my arm, my head, my shoulder, a blind assault. The rock stack rises to meet me. You stand before it, 100, maybe 200 feet. If we make contact, I'll take you with me. I hear hard pack ice hammering more than I feel it. My heels stutter, stumbling, scrabbling. I dig in, brace, flex my knees. The slope slows its onrush. I dig in harder, harder. Regain the axe. The mountain ceases to move. Nothing to it. My hands shake. My knees quiver. I can't stand up. So I plant my axe a little too firmly, begin more carefully. By the time I reach you, I've managed to consider what I've done to save myself.
Wow. So you've done that same thing, a very specific moment. This time it's you, not the birds. And then brought it to a human sort of lesson, growth. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I like tooth. You've got tooth in there, and you had toothy waves in the other one. And I remember learning from a poet who had been a student of Hugo's, and he said that Hugo said that we all have words that are emotionally charged for us, and we use them a lot. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if tooth and toothy might be some of the words for you.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I do another poem with teeth, and it came to mind, and it was sitting death watch with my father.
Oh.
And slow teeth. Just eating him away at the end.
Mm. I hear the charge in those poems because the waves are scary and toothy, and the moment where you're climbing is scary. And losing someone is scary in another way. So I think we don't think about it as poets, but it's interesting when we go back and look for the words. And Hugo thought that was wonderful.
Mm.
He thought it was just how it is. We have obsessions, and we have words that we choose to share those with. So anything you want to tell us about being a writer, committing to writing, caring about writing?
Absolutely. Creativity is part of my life. It's a daily practice. And if I'm not working on a narrative, I'm working on poems. I'm part of the collaborative here in town. As you know, you're part of it
too. Maybe you can tell us what that is.
It's a collaborative between poets and artists and musicians creating work together. With Sarah Zale and Jay Haskins. Sarah is a poet and Jay is a painter, quite an extraordinary painter. We end up painting together on a canvas, not imagistically. It's an emotional response to what's on the canvas, which is often what writing is. We've created two really interesting poems. One of them was an Asian form, and I've never written Asian forms, so it was a challenge and quite fun. The latest one is a narrative poem that I can actually relate to a little more easily, but I do enjoy the challenge of the form that I was unfamiliar with. Both turned out beautifully, and both paintings are compelling. So I do recommend, create your community and work with them. It's great.
Absolutely. You're one of several groups that are part of this project.
Yes. Yeah.
It sounds a little scary at first, like if you're a writer and not a painter, a painter, not a writer, not a musician, are a musician. But there is something magic about sharing in a different form of creativity and seeing the likenesses.
And the idea of having no idea. In our group, there are three of us. We have no idea what we're planning to do until we do it. And it's terrifying and freeing at the same time. What a complex emotion that creates.
You know, I think that's a very good definition of making art.
Yeah, I do.
It's terrifying and freeing. And I think it's the terrifying part that can keep people from the page or the canvas. And the method of getting over it that you've shared with us is imagining the playful aspects that you never know what's going to happen, and that's a joy. And I think that it does take a certain sturdiness to, especially when you're writing from a dark side, as some of your novel is, it can really be too scary to approach. So how do we do that if we're feeling somehow too afraid to enjoy the playful part?
Well, my compulsion is to just do it. The most recent one would be with the collaboration and trying to create a Renku, not having ever read one. The way I finally gave in to the fear, and which in giving in to the fear, just recognizing that it existed, that I was fearful of doing the wrong thing. It's not life and death. How can you be doing the wrong thing if this is your creative impetus? I don't want to be a Nike commercial, but just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it releases, just the first step will release the fear.
But let's go back to the poem you wrote that you referred to about being on death watch with your father. I think sometimes it's the subject that creates the fear, not just that we have to create and we don't know what we're going to create. But when you are about to lose somebody so significant in your life, and then you write a poem about it, is there a kind of feeling like, how can my writing ever achieve the depth and height of such an important situation or moment?
As I'm thinking about it, while you're asking it, I'm thinking, I don't believe I allowed that into my consciousness. The way that the poem occurred was out of my grief. And this is my father, whom I adored, and who adored me. That's a big loss. That is a huge loss. The person in your life you were always able to count on, and that was my father for me. So that poem came out of grief, and it took over a year to complete. I had a first rough draft of it, but it didn't say everything that I needed it to say in order for me to let the grief go and let my father go, though I really have never let him go. It's still a way of letting the pain out a little bit at a time.
So I think it was really significant to me when you said, this was written for my grief. So you can own your own feeling and in that way overcome the idea that it's too big for me to write about.
Right.
Because the feeling might be big, but it is yours, and you can express it. So I want to thank you so, so much for all the talk about creativity. And it's been a joy to hear the prose and the poetry, the words, to learn about your process. I think these are golden, not only for writers, but for people who read, to know that it doesn't just magically happen and that it's important.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.